Okay, we're going to get started. I think some people will probably be making their way downstairs, but we only have an hour, and we have a great panel, and want to have plenty of time for the discussion. So I'll just get started with a few words of introduction to frame the panel, and then turn it over to Dr. Buford, who will be moderating the session. So I just, again, wanted to thank you for joining us today for the panel and all of our panelists. We have a terrific group of speakers with us to share their experiences working across sectors to improve community health and discuss strategies and challenges. Moderating today's panel is Dr. Joe Ivy Buford, President of the International Society of Urban Health, a global organization committed to making cities healthier by addressing the broad determinants of health and health disparities. She's also an RPA board member, and we're thrilled to have her here today with us to lead this discussion. Thank you. I would also like to welcome Nancy Kopperman, Vice President for Community Health at Northwell, Sharon Greenberger, President of New York City YMCA, Dr. Malo Hudson, Director of the Urban Planning PhD Program at Columbia University and the Director of Columbia's Urban Community and Health Equity Lab, Charles Richman, Executive Director of the New Jersey Housing and Mortgage Finance Agency, and Vin Tufo, CEO of Charter Oak Communities in Stamford, Connecticut. So before I turn over the panel to Dr. Buford, I'd like to take a few minutes to frame the conversation. I wanted to just talk a little bit about why talk about health at the RPA Assembly. What is the relationship between health and the built environment? Why are we all here to talk about this on our panel? Oh, gosh, sorry. Apologies. So sorry. Embarrassing. Okay, no. It's not even showing up there at all. Oh, gosh. Yeah, I could. Thank you. Sorry. Oh, I thought Arvin was actually going to just fix that. But. Oh, okay. We're on. Okay, great. It's not showing on mine, but I'm just going to look over there and hope for the best. Okay, great. So, okay, when people think about health, they think about healthcare, right? But we know that actually healthcare is only 20% of what makes up someone's overall health, that actually 80% of the factors that play into our health are things like housing, access to food, access to transportation, the air we breathe, access to education, open space, and things like that. Hopefully that will change the slide. No, it's not. Oh, I'm sorry, folks. This is... We're having a little technical problem. Yeah. Sorry. Something's not speaking to each other.
Communicating to each other.
It's not talking. It's thank you.
Yeah. This is where this is.
Yeah, that's where I'd like to be.
So it froze.
It froze. Okay.
All right. So 1 second. Sorry.
It's okay.
So completely close it. All right. So where's your PowerPoint?
I guess try that. Carnegie Room.
Okay, there we go.
Okay. Yeah, there you go. Okay, thank you.
All right. And we'll just.
Okay.
We'll just use
that, yeah.
I think it's your mouse.
Okay, the mouse didn't like it. Okay, sorry, folks. Getting back on track. Okay, so just very briefly, a little bit of framing. Again, why RPA, talking about health. Health and equity were two of the central values that we talked about in our fourth regional plan, and they guide the work of RPA. In our research for the fourth plan, we looked closely at the relationship between people's health and where they live, the built environment, and we looked at strategies for fostering healthy communities in the region. Urban health experts know that in order to achieve health, we must improve the built social, economic, and physical environments where people live, work, and play. And the research clearly shows that where people live is linked with how long they live. And many of the disparities that we see in health outcomes in the region are connected to urban planning decisions, as we know, decisions like housing policies that have perpetuated segregation in our region. And therefore, we also see that race and ethnicity are linked with health outcomes. A clear example, literally as basic as the air we breathe, people of color are more likely to live in areas with higher air pollution levels. And looking to the future, we'll be facing new challenges as well in community health. The share of seniors in the region is expected to double by 2040, and we need a built environment that supports their needs. And at the same time, our infrastructure is also aging, and it's often inaccessible. Anyone who's taken the subway in New York City has seen that moment where there's someone who's trying to walk up the stairs with a cane or with a stroller. So how can organizations in our region work together to improve health? What is already happening, what else is needed, and how do we make it happen? So with those few words just of framing, I want to just turn the discussion over now to Dr. Jo Ivy Buford, who will talk about her work in this space and the need for cross-sector conversation and collaboration, and thankfully doesn't need to use the PowerPoint slide.
Thanks very much, Melissa. Welcome to everybody. This session is called Building Healthy Places, and you see the word health. You don't see the word health down the hall and around the corner, but from our point of view, they're all talking about health. So I think one of the messages out of this panel is health does not necessarily equal health care or health care only. And I think that's the big message you're going to hear from a lot of people, some of who discovered it on the way to working on different projects in different sectors and other who have been very explicit about it. I've been really excited to be on the board of RPA because for the reasons that Melissa stated, when I was at the New York Academy of Medicine, there was a wonderful partnership in the writing of the fourth regional plan, really introducing health as one of the themes. And I think everybody was a bit surprised at how much traction the idea had and how people in the RPA and the constituency were really quite aware of the potential positive or negative effects of the work that they were doing. So it's been great to see it further develop. One moment about the International Society for Urban Health. We are the only global non-governmental organization focusing on the broad determinants of health and health equity. Our focus is on cities because 70% of the world's population lives in cities, and they produce about 70% of the GDP, but also 60% of the waste, air pollution, and using 60% of the energy. So in the global space, without addressing healthy cities, creating healthy cities, you don't get to a global health goal, and I would argue that that's also relevant for the U.S. The bubble diagram Melissa showed, I think, reflects how decisions made in every sector can have a positive or negative health effect. I don't want to pick on transportation, but it's one of the more obvious ones in the sense that a decision made about a huge capital investment, whether it goes into mass transit or more roads and cars, obviously has a huge impact on human health in terms of air pollution, road traffic accidents, lack of sidewalks, and less walking, and there's data to document those things now. It's just not a notional issue, and I think that is a big change in the last decade or so in thinking about the broader determinants of health. We actually have an evidence base for the work. Also, just to mention that Governor Cuomo in November issued an executive order calling for health across all policies in New York State, and that executive order said that in thinking about contracting, purchasing program, and capital investments as well as policy, all state agencies needed to talk about the health impact, and he's also declared New York State the first age-friendly state in the United States, and sort of those are traveling together dealing with the issues of built and natural environment. On this panel, you're going to hear case studies of public-private partnerships really grounded in communities and in serving communities, even though they may start out as human service programs or housing-focused or land-use-focused. Many of them have really developed an awareness of and an increasing focus on developing things that act on the different determinants of health, so the idea of safe housing or economic development or environment and social cohesiveness in communities. You're going to hear that. Happily, the descriptions in your program give a nice bio of everyone here. Melissa's given you their titles, and I think you can hear a snippet. I think this is one of those things where each of them has the speed dating version of here's my project, and you know where to find them when the session is over. We'll give each of the speakers about 3 to 4 minutes, and then I'll ask some questions across the panel, and then we'll open it to you in the last 10 minutes or so of the session, hopefully. So we're going to go right down the list here, and so Mallow is going to kind of contextualize this conversation in relation to the issues of health equity, which are challenges for everybody.
Yes, well, thank you very much, Dr. Buford, and also thank you, Melissa, for the nice introduction. It's always a pleasure to see my colleagues. I hear so much about the great work they're doing, but we oftentimes get a chance to sit down and have these conversations. My name is Mallow Hudson. I'm a professor at Columbia University. My focus is really around urban planning and health equity, so my work is at that intersection. I co-founded and direct the Urban Community and Health Equity Lab, and the goal is real simple: to break down these silos within universities to think about complex issues in the world that relate to these things we're going to talk about today. So one area that my lab focuses on is the built environment in health. And so that's thinking about housing, transportation, infrastructure, water resources, sanitation, those sorts of things. And really think about how could we partner not only within the Graduate School of Architecture and Planning, but with engineering, with public health, with public affairs, and so forth. The second component of my work is around community development and health equity. So much of the work that I do really cannot happen without real engagement of local residents in the process, because they are the local experts. They understand what's impacting them in their daily lives. And so what I try to do with my students and my colleagues is come to the table and say, how can we partner together, right? Sort of break, get out of the ivory tower, so to speak, and really get into the community. And the last piece is law and governance. So we focus quite a bit around local land use laws and governance, the role of state, federal policy, and then there's a big strand of our work that's international, but for today I'm going to focus more domestically. There are two projects I'll talk about briefly. One is housing and health. So I've been working with, one of my former students here, Alexandria Moskowitz. We've been talking quite a bit about housing and health and the role that it plays. Alex, you have to lift up your hands. People are looking way in the back. But you, obviously, we all heard about neighborhood change, displacement, gentrification. I've been looking in San Francisco, Boston, New York, and Washington, D.C. My most recent book is on that. Really trying to understand what's happening to people in those communities. How are they surviving? Oftentimes, we always discuss, well, these are the gentrifiers, it's this person's fault. I want to know, how are people surviving? What are their stories? And as you start to talk to, whether it be a grandmother in the Mission District, predominantly Latinx community in San Francisco, I'm getting sick because I'm taking care of my granddaughter and I'm worried about the constant stress of paying my bills, or I'm doubled and tripled up, whether you're in D.C. and so forth. And so really telling that narrative. So we're continuing that work. And then another project that I'm very proud of is a food systems project. I was contacted about 5 years ago by the General Counsel of Oakland Unified School District that said, we want to build a central kitchen, instructional farm, and education center to bring locally sourced food to children in Oakland Unified School District. The children in the school district, about 70% qualify for free and reduced price lunch, so they definitely meet the federal poverty guidelines. We were successful in getting that built. It'll launch in September, but more importantly, we went from one school district, which is about 87 schools, in California, to 89 school districts. And now there's a program called California Food for California Kids that's run by the Center for Equal Literacy. And we're working with the state as well to think about, how do we offer more locally sourced meals across California. So you can imagine 3 million meals a year. We're in 89 school districts. The majority of the children qualify for free and reduced price lunch. And we are now doing analysis on the procurement, we're looking at consumption of the actual food, we're looking at educational outcomes. So a lot of things that we're doing in this project, but it's an example of how you can go from one small pilot project to then think about scale. So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. Sharon?
Hi, I'm Sharon Greenberger with the YMCA of Greater New York. We're a community service organization with 24 branches and 75 offsite locations in the 5 boroughs of the city. We serve about 500,000 New Yorkers every year, and we're focused really on 3 things: empowering youth, improving health, and strengthening community. We're a legacy institution that's been around for almost 170 years, and so I thought I'd share a couple of things that have characterized our work going back and looking forward that I think are applicable across sectors. One is, we believe very strongly in the hub and spoke model. Our branches serve as anchor institutions, and then we work with our community partners, whether they're schools or hospitals or other providers or government, to make sure that we're meeting people where they are. We know that we can meet families in schools more readily than at a branch. We're in NYCHA housing, we're in senior centers, so that we really expand our reach as extensively as possible. Part of that also recognizes that physical space still counts. There's a lot we can do with technology, but those human connections remain super important. So that's one. The second is we really believe in prevention as intervention. When we teach a kid to swim, we're really teaching drowning prevention. If we infuse healthy activity into after school, we're again always focused on what are the skills and habits that people can take with for life. The prevention piece is very important. The third is around making sure that we're always aware what are the barriers that we want to reduce. What are those? How can we best reduce barriers to entry? We're particularly focused on three. One is people come at different ages and different stages in life, so making sure that they have access and how we communicate that is important. Certainly language is a barrier. All of our branches serve very diverse communities, so we make sure that the staff reflects the communities. We make sure we have multiple languages available. And then always around financial assistance, making sure that people understand that pricing finances are not an obstacle to entry. So that's a third. Fourth, to your point, is around how to scale best practices, but also respond locally. And that's, I think, a real art. It involves a fair amount of alchemy, trying to figure out what are those best practices. So for us, it might be around swimming. It might be around healthy eating. It might be around a particular senior programming that we offer universally, but at the same time really focused on making sure we're meeting the needs of our local communities. So one project in particular that I wanted to focus on was our expansion in the Bronx. We're building two new branches in the Bronx, one in the northeast neighborhood with Sharon Tepper from EDC, who's been quite instrumental in making sure that happens, and one in the South Bronx. Very different communities, and we've been doing a lot of community mapping work to best understand what are those service needs. So in the northeast Bronx, where there are more older adults living in isolation who report higher rates of loneliness, our programming will focus on volunteerism opportunities, places and opportunities to bring people in. In the South Bronx, we have recent immigrants who are facing issues, so we'll infuse those programmings with our new American Welcome Centers. So again, scaling best, but also thinking about what's local. And then finally, I would say, is always coming back to this notion of community and connections. I know we all know people are so hungry for a personal connection to their community. What we see in our branches is that whether it's our Bed-Stuy Senior Splashers or our basketball groups at McBurney Y, people look for those sub-communities. They want those connections, and those communities end up being eyes and ears, right? So if somebody doesn't show up, they take it upon themselves to call and follow up. It is that personal connection that we are seeing more and more in demand. So those five are sort of five characteristics that we're seeing across all of our branches that I think do contribute to creating healthy communities.
Great. Thank you very much. Nancy.
Thank you for coming today and listening to us. My name is Nancy Copperman. I'm Vice President of Community Health in a newly formed division at Northwell Health. Our CEO, Michael Dowling, recruited Dr. Ram Raju, who was previously the CEO of Health and Hospitals, to come to our health system to not focus on transplanting any organ or developing a new clinical service line or to look at his administration skills, but to actually focus on social determinants of health. And part of the mission of our division really is to kind of look at total health. So we know that clinical care can get you so much, but then as you are discharged from our facilities or engage in our primary care practices, a hospital has four walls, but really three of them are in the community or open to the community. So we focus on kind of what are the causes of social determinants of health. And I think this is an important way to look at it. One of the stories that Dr. Raju tells is that, you know, we have people that are in the river and they're drowning. So what do? We throw them a life preserver and we keep them in the river. And they go downstream until they lose their life preserver and then they're drowning again. Someone else throws them a life preserver. So, you know, wouldn't it be good, rather than leaving the people in the river, to actually pull them out of the river and put them on a new path? So one of the things that we've embarked upon with about 40 other of the larger health systems in the country is to join what we call the Health Anchor Network of the Democracy Collaborative. And this Healthcare Anchor Network really focuses on the local hiring, local procurement, and local place-based investment that health systems have. Northwell Health is the largest health system in New York State. We have over 70,000 employees. We spend approximately $5 million on produce alone, plus our building, et cetera. So the idea is, how can we use our economic power, not necessarily to, you know, to build or provide life preservers, but how can we kind of go to the root of the issue of poverty, which really generates all these social determinants of health? So yes, there's an acute issue, and we have some programs that deal with food insecurity, but how can we kind of take it a step back and look at some of the data where, you know, longevity and economic wellness? And what we've done is we've started off with hiring. As I said before, we have roughly about 70,000 employees. Every week we basically bring in 150 new employees that come to our corporate offices. So the question is, how can we be more strategic in some of the hiring we do? So we have, in collaboration and with the support of JP Morgan Chase, launched a community health worker program. And the program really looks to people that are living in communities with health disparities, because you know what, you can't address a health disparity by looking at kind of like social equity. So like health, there's no health equity without social equity. So we recruit from the communities people who are underemployed or unemployed. We work with intermediaries, and those are our community partnerships. And we've embarked with the New York State Department of Health in a grant that they received from Robert Wood Johnson to start kind of advocating and showing other anchor institutions such as education and other industry on how they can use their local power to actually impact communities. So we've done... we have our community health worker program where we kind of look at bringing in people not only to work in Northwell Health, but to work with our community-based organizations in the realm of population health management. And this is a whole new field for kind of these frontline workers. But it's not just bringing someone in and keeping them as a frontline worker. As the slide shows, you have to have a career path. And you have to be able to have these people come in and have them gain a livable wage over time. So it involves a lot of recruiting, partnership with community, but also internal education. We have a veterans program where we've brought in over 600 veterans. And what we had to do is we had to work with the veterans to see what skills they had, translate those into healthcare opportunities. And then we had to work with hiring managers so that they understand, if you're a captain and you ran a logistics operation, what does that mean? Where do you fit in? And the newest program that we've launched is actually a program for people with autism. And how do we now work with people with autism and bring them into the health system and work with us? And again, it's a whole culture change in team and how people work together. So this is just one kind of piece, but the other thing that we're doing is really advocacy so that we can get other people to join. Because if we can look at economic development and start addressing that, and having people be able to create and build wealth, then over time, that's what's going to solve a lot of the social determinants of health.
Chuck? Go ahead.
Yes. A challenge.
That's easy.
No, it's not, particularly since all I do is deal with money. So about 3 years back, in a different position I held, we launched with the Camden Coalition in Camden, New Jersey, a Housing First program with Cooper Hospital. And we asked the hospital to identify their frequent users of the emergency room and seeing if we couldn't intervene with that group with social services and a stable housing environment and therefore take pressure off the emergency room as well as take some costs off. Because charity care is an enormous cost to New Jersey state government. We gave them 25 vouchers to begin the program, started to collect data. The data was so good that we expanded it to a statewide program of about 750 vouchers working throughout the state and probably 12 or 14 hospitals directly involved. Other social service groups are doing it. And we'll be publishing the data probably in 6 to 8 months from now, but it's been remarkable how the intervention has worked. About a year ago, I brought a group together to talk about this relationship we built with the hospitals and how we can expand upon it. And what we've developed is a program where we've asked the hospitals to work with us to build affordable housing and to expand from their, generally it's urban, but generally expand from their base, from their the anchor institution that they are, into the neighborhoods that are adjoining the hospitals. And so we spent probably 4 or 5 months meeting with the state's hospital association and then individual hospitals, and last December asked for letters of intent. 8 hospital groups nominated 9 sites. We've moved ahead with 6 hospital groups into a detailed program to finance this relationship. It's an interesting economic model. And, we've asked the hospitals to put up 50% of the equity. So I don't know how familiar you are with low-income housing tax credits, but the 4% tax credit is a way of providing for about a third of the cost of new construction. And the rest gets built upon by some mortgage on the housing to pay for, that's paid for by rents, but there's always a pretty healthy gap that you need equity. And what we've done is put up, or challenge the hospitals, if you will, to put up 50% of the equity, and HMFA, out of our profit, will match 50% of the equity. And it took a the idea worked really well with the medical side of the hospitals and the folks dealing with the community. It was really a challenge with the CFOs. Didn't understand it, didn't know anything about housing, didn't want on their balance sheet something that wasn't directly hospital related. But we're overcoming that. And so I expect at least 4 projects to move forward to the initial financing within the next 6 to 8 months. 2 of the hospitals have projects actually in design. These are $15 to $20 million projects, 60 to 80 units. 10 of the units are reserved for individuals that were identified or continue to be identified in the program that led to the Housing First model. So 10 will be set aside for individuals that need extra attention, that the services will be brought there. And we're providing Section 8 vouchers to cover the cost of those units. The remainder will be affordable units in the neighborhoods. We kind of define the neighborhoods as neighborhoods that are threatened but viable. In many of our urban hospitals, those neighborhoods are on the tipping point. And we believe that building the housing out into those neighborhoods will help create a stable environment. The other challenge we made to the hospitals was we expected on the first floor of these rental properties some medical-related facilities. And they're being designed that way. I can pay for the fit-up. I can't pay for the equipment. But we're working with our Economic Development Authority as a possibility of helping make that happen faster. We call it a pilot because that allows me to avoid doing rules and regulations, which is working. But I expect certainly from the initial take, is that this is something we'll have as an ongoing activity. And some of the hospital executives have really gotten deeply involved. We told them their application had to include the social service provider, had to include a nonprofit that works in the neighborhood. So we wanted a holistic development around it. And they've stepped up to do that. So it's still a pilot. We haven't built the first one. We haven't even broken ground on the first one. But we're encouraged that the hospital community has really bought into this as a way of joining the neighborhood and certainly providing a broader sense of healthcare. We started talking about housing as healthcare, and that has resonated really well with the legislature. And so it's been a tough start, but I think it's something we'd love to continue. We've talked to RPA about continuing to keep them involved in knowing what we're doing and help us to evaluate what the program provides.
All right, great. I'm Vin Tufo. I'm the CEO of Charter Oak Communities in Stamford, Connecticut. I want to tell you a little bit about Charter Oak Communities and a little bit about Stamford. Spoiler alert, we're about 20 years into the type of initiative that Chuck has talked about. So we can certainly talk about what went well and where we ended up, and here's where we ended up. So as what you see is a combination, kind of a collage of housing, but also a lot of stuff that's not housing. We have urban farming. We have community cohesion. We certainly have integration of the community, both public housing residents and residents throughout not only the west side of Stamford where it lives, but also throughout the entire city. So it's really helped to bring us all together. And I think that's one of the overriding themes of this panel is the connections, both connections across sectors for organizations working together outside of their disciplines, but also connections and building or rebuilding connections within the communities that are so important to us. So I'll describe Charter Oak Communities a little bit and then talk about the work that we've done over that 20-year time span. So Charter Oak, as you see from the bio, is what's called a progressive housing authority. And it's not a contradiction in terms. It actually is possible. Takes a certain amount of effort and vision, but it is certainly possible. Because housing authorities are very powerful engines, and if they're used in a way that really does essentially address the kinds of concerns that we've talked about today and the opportunities that we've talked about, they can actually evolve perhaps a hybrid approach, which is what we are, but into much more sustainable, certainly a more positive relationship with the community. Stamford, if you don't... haven't been through it on the Connecticut Turnpike or haven't spent any time in Stamford. It's a mid-sized city, relatively self-contained, about 130,000 people, economically vibrant, which also means, as the Governor Lamont was talking about this morning, we have excellent services, really an excellent school system and public safety, but it's also probably the most expensive city in Connecticut. So it really creates a lot of hardship and disadvantage for the community that we serve, traditionally serve as a housing authority. But this vision that I mentioned, which began about 20 years ago, was to really turn our traditional institution, which again started life in the 1930s or so, and ended up very much like many housing authorities around the country, not just medium-sized, but certainly we've talked about NYCHA and even small housing authorities as really providing the best they could provide was really housing of last resort. So what we tried to do is to pivot, if you will, on the millennium and say, what can we possibly do to create a community of choice, a housing of choice environment? And the more we thought about that and talked about it, and I allude to Nancy's comment as really how do we create a system in our communities where we're not just pulling people out of the river, but we're keeping them from falling into the river in the first place, is to really create a positive environment, an affordable environment, one that's of high quality, one that's desirable, and one that embodies connections really across these sectors, health, education, public safety, nutrition, et cetera. And, of course, the logical extension of that is we can't do it alone. No housing authority, no community development organization, no hospital can really address this situation by themselves. So what you really need to do is to figure out how and with whom you're going to establish partnerships. And our primary partner, our founding partner, let's say, in our work, is our local hospital. It's an independent hospital, Stamford Health, but they're small, but they're mighty, we like to say, and they also got it as well. And their capital investment in our developments, including some of what you see there, was not monetary, it was in land. So we did a land swap where property that we owned that was in the neighborhood, but more beneficial to them, adjacent to the hospital, was exchanged with no cost for hospital-owned property that was, if you will, scattered elsewhere in the neighborhood, but better for housing. And the value of that land swap was about $20 million. But there were, again, no appraisals, no money changed hands, really very little that was done other than signing over of deeds. But that enabled the development to start, and that enabled us to de-densify the housing. What came out of that was a coordinated master plan where the hospital and Charter Oak Communities collaborated with the neighborhood to rezone the neighborhood as a village commercial district and create an environment that was not only going to support our development efforts but invite other private and public interests to come into that neighborhood. We completed $750 million of redevelopment, including a brand new hospital and 550 units of mixed-income housing. But the thing that we're most proud of is that we created a lasting collective impact-based collaborative called the Vita Health and Wellness District, with the farm as sort of the centerpiece, but involving 20 partner organizations from across all sectors, health, public health, FQHCs, human services organizations, educational organizations, the city, community colleges, and so forth. And then the results of that are, yes, to create mixed-use properties with medical on the first floor, but also urban agriculture, parks, public safety, and a much more walkable, cohesive neighborhood. So that's what 20 years will get you in Stamford. 20 years to life, actually. But it's been quite an experience. We're still going. Thank you.
That's great. Thank you. Terrific. Congratulations to everybody for being on time and also saying an awful lot, putting it in a very cohesive way and coherent way. Let me start. I'm going to try to do two or three questions here before we open up to the audience. All of you have, I want to do a deeper dive into this issue of partnerships, intersectoral working across, you know, health sector, transportation, housing, and others, and interdisciplinary scholarship, which is no joke. I mean, you said, oh, this is really easy. We're doing this up here. It's not actually for those of you that aren't in the university. So just to pick up on Vinny's last work. I mean, you said 20 years getting to where you are. Could you talk a little bit about what the biggest challenges have been in this partnership, intersectoral interdisciplinary working, however you want to frame it, and sort of what worked? We want to hear about, you know, the major issue, but also how you got through it.
It's interesting to look that retrospectively, 20 years before there was an Affordable Care Act, before we talked about the social determinants of health, certainly broadly, before we had a lot of examples to point to that would say to our potential partners, hey, this is what's worked elsewhere, because there wasn't a lot that had worked elsewhere at that point. So what we really felt were two things. One is to figure out what the particular interests were of the institutions, my institution and the hospital institution, and where those interests would align. But then the other thing, and this is going to be the case, it's certainly the case when you're working with any institutional partner, is to identify the barriers to entry and then to start to build trust by doing things collaboratively, by essentially putting one step in front of the other and then being able to recognize that there's things that you can accomplish collaboratively that you can't do individually. The last thing, though, and maybe this, I'm not sure if this is a unifying theme or not, is that the consistency of leadership. Nancy talked about a new CEO coming in. Many of us have had the experience of working with a mayor, working with elected representatives, working with CEOs of institutions and CFOs of institutions, and then just when you get to the point of being able to do a deal, that person leaves, or the philosophy changes, or a mayor goes out of office, a new mayor comes in. The consistency of leadership, so it's possibly building resilience at the board level, really not just relying on one particular leader or one particular mayor, but really building some bench strength in those relationships, because those are the individuals that are really going to push the button and make the deal work.
It's really helpful. What about other sort of comments from other members of the panel? Sharon, I saw you nodding your head actively in terms of your exercise in the Bronx.
No, I think what's really one of the things that we have been focused on is demonstrating the impact of that partnership. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's one thing to say that you want to partner together and there are ways to do that, but really being very clear about what that means, and then actually working, whether it's with an academic institution where you can judge over time what has mattered, or if you've created a set of goals that have been met, but coming back to using the data effectively and really saying, we set out to do this, here's what worked, here's what didn't, here's how we're demonstrating the impact of that intervention
I actually think is quite challenging. And what we're finding is that more and more, especially from a funding perspective, people are demanding and asking to see that impact. And so being very thoughtful about that from the get-go, what's feasible, how long will things take, how much support do we need, and then setting out to manage those things together has become very important.
Thank you. Chuck, you were leaning forward. Did you want to jump in on this one?
Obviously, my focus is on the lending side. And two interesting things. One is in terms of if you're ever dreaming about doing this. I didn't think about it when we were doing it, but in having all the hospitals together in presentations and getting it started, we created a peer pressure movement. And once the first couple of hospitals signed on, others really got worried about, because we only said we were going to do a few projects, others started figuring out what to do and coming forward with more and more how they would make it work. And that's a very effective technique that worked out by accident, didn't think about it. The other is, and mentioned, there's been mention about the capital stack. The hospitals took a deep breath when we talked about $2 to $4 million contribution toward construction. That's $2 to $4 million in 18 months. And we hit on, and we had really good bond counsel working for us, we figured out that we could lend to the hospital the amount of money for their equity contribution. So instead of a $2 to $4 million contribution up front to the construction, they're going to be paying a loan back to HMFA for 15 years at a market rate of maybe $150,000 to $200,000 a year.
Yeah.
Should be easy.
Yep.
And that really put it across. So it was the continued hard working on the finance side to convince that CFO that the hospital's not going to go broke building a floor.
Yeah. And the notion of a service entity in the first floor also is potentially revenue generating. It's really nice.
And that worked in two of the urban hospitals that have real problems in our emergency room in terms of volume. Building this entity two blocks away is going to relieve some of that pressure. That's so there was a back and forth that really worked in building those connections.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're crossing multiple bridges because everyone in academia is not that keen necessarily to work outside, to be externally facing, shall we say, in terms of collaborating. And then similarly, urban health, by definition, and disparities is interdisciplinary. So just give us a word or two about the challenge, because I think we all look to academic institutions, appropriately so, to really help with the kind of evaluation that Sharon was talking about. But it's not so easy.
It's not so easy. And, there's a tension, an inherent tension in academia where we focus on our silos, our focus as free agents, as academics, and there's really no incentive to go out and do more. And so I think when we think about the 21st century university as to what's the purpose of it, right? Is it to accumulate huge endowments and just have students go out and get a job, or is it actually go train people and use our research to actually have an impact in the world? And so that's how I've been trained, and being at Columbia has been nice because, to the credit of President Lee Bollinger, he has actually said that we need to start thinking about the broader perspective of our research from the medical school all the way to the humanities. How can we have an impact on things like climate change, energy access, inequality, maternal health, and really challenging us as academics to do more and to not just bring in grants, stay in our silos, but actually to say, in order to address some of these most complex issues in the world, we need to partner not only across Columbia University, but with people like yourselves at the table here, and also with the private sector and so forth. So it's not easy, but you have to start.
Yeah. No, it's great. I want to start off. I'm going to make sure we cover a couple topics here. So I'm going to start off and ask Nancy to pick up on this one. All of you have mentioned the importance of community engagement in the success of whatever you're doing. Now, as a system as big as Northwell, you're sort of the 800-pound gorilla. And as you hear a lot about community engagement, especially in the hospital sector, like, why now? You've been here for 20 years. You haven't really worked. I'm not saying Northwell has, but, the kinds of issues you faced and sort of what worked in terms of community engagement from your perspective.
I think that it's a different perspective on what community engagement really is. And I think that in looking at just my career in healthcare, original community engagement was really based on providing health fairs, health lectures, and community screenings. And how do we partner to kind of bring these types of programs to the community? And that was kind of where everyone thought the engagement would be. And also chambers of commerce, things of that nature, right? So I think now what's happening is that health systems and hospitals of all sizes are understanding that the quality of relationships with the community needs to be something that's going to impact both the community as well as the hospital. And I think what's driving this a lot is the, especially now over the past 5 years, I've been integrally involved with the Medicaid redesign waiver program, DSHRA. And I think what people are starting to see now is that we have to integrate with our community-based organizations and look to them as other service providers. And what's very interesting is that, you know, I always thought in sitting with hospitals and doing collaborative work, you know, the tension, the competitiveness, things like that, I thought, you know, really that's like a hospital thing. Well, I can tell you that I now sit with a bunch of financial institutions that are looking at a funders collaborative to bring all the financial institutions together on Long Island and kind of look to see how can we, rather than like people doing financial coaching and this program and that, how can we all, in the same communities, how can we all kind of come together and pool our resources and do impactful work? And I see that kind of tension and competitiveness there. I work with a lot of food resource organizations and bringing people together. I see the tension there because from a community-based organization point of view, there's limited dollars and everybody's kind of fighting for the same piece. So I would say what's really kind of changed, A, is that trust building. And that's been probably the first thing that we all had to do in working with intermediaries in our local hiring program. A lot of the intermediaries whose deliverable is to get, let's say, post-incarceration clients into employment, they don't really trust the health system because they think that we can't hire them. And because they've had this interaction that, you know, we're automatically going to say no. So, and then for us, understanding that these people that are coming in, you know, have a support system. So I think that community engagement now for health systems, people are stepping back and looking at what we can do. One of the things that a lot of health systems in the New York City area are embarking upon now is looking at technology and looking at different platforms that actually now as you do screening for social determinants of health, how do you, through electronic platforms, then connect the patients with a community-based organization or a community resource that solve that? So kind of it's gone from, like, the discharge planner who, like, hands somebody, like, a list and say, okay, we hope you connect, to now kind of having that connection. And then the next piece of this kind of goes to funding. So, yeah.
I'm going to talk about that in a minute.
Yeah,
but
the point is on this is that, you know, as you create these connections and now you're starting to link the services, it's looking at the capacity. So I think this is a more thoughtful way that it's just not Northwell, but other healthcare institutions are looking to partner and develop more quality relationships than these one-offs.
Mm-hmm. Vincent, I want you to give us 20-year perspective on the evolution of your engagement with the community. And not really the partnership issue as much as sort of the entry, the credibility, getting the ideas. Obviously, there's been a diverse agenda that's evolved over time.
Do you want the whole 20 years?
No, just like 2 minutes worth. 3 minutes worth is good. No, what was the turning point? Was there a turning point?
Before we get to the turning point, we'll have to go back to where things were.
Okay, this is fine.
Any institution and its community has a fraught relationship potentially, but more often than not, there's both tension, lack of trust, lack of expectation that the institution is going to, it really has the interest of the community in mind. Housing authorities are way, way, way at the end of the spectrum of lack of regard, lack of trust, because of history, because of essentially the the relationship that we typically have with low-income, disadvantaged, very unempowered populations. The housing authority has run somewhat roughshod over those populations for a very, very long time. So when you're beginning to work on a redevelopment initiative, and we started working on redevelopment in Stamford in the mid-1990s, you really have to start from that place. And it's not so much a question of developing a shared vision initially and certainly coming up with an agenda that can develop into this collaborative, this happy collaborative that we talked about. But it's really reckoning and coming to terms with the way that relationship is and the way it's been shaped, and really trying to be somewhat but humble but also realistic that it's going to take some time. And so I think the takeaway, if to sort of capsulize how it then turned into a more positive relationship, is that you have to assume that there's that listening is a huge part of it, that you're not going to be able to rush it, that it's going to take both more process and more time and maybe some bumps in the road that you didn't anticipate and that we certainly don't normally include in our strategic planning when we're planning just for our own organizations, mm-hmm. but this is now planning as a collaborative. What also helps, if you've ever heard the adage, never waste a crisis, is that if you can identify a crisis, in other words, is there potential displacement that's there? Is there potential for the community to lose an essential asset, such as a public housing development that's not habitable, or a hospital that's potentially going to shut down if essentially the community can't get its act together? So I think the strategies are very much bottom-up and top-down, but clearly they have to achieve first a common vision and then a set of, and then acting on those set of common goals.
Great, thanks. Yeah, Mala, let me ask you a couple minutes on sort of any different observations, because I know community engagement's at the center of your scholarship. So how does that work for you, just very briefly, and then we want to find out about where the money comes from before we finish panel and open it up.
It's a good question. I'll be short. I think it's just meeting people where they are, understanding you're not the expert as a professor, but you have skills, right? So maybe it's mapping or certain type of economic analysis, statistical analysis, but really engaging residents and trying to hear what their challenges are and needs are and then work together to do mm-hmm. that.
That's really important. Excellent. So a couple minutes from everybody on money. Some of you have mentioned the money. I mean, we've got some pretty sophisticated models. Chuck has mentioned that from his model. Obviously, it's emerged as well from what Vinny was mentioning. Nancy, Sharon, you want to, I mean, everybody in the healthcare industry says, you know, that's what you're describing is not my job and I can't spend my money on it. You want to start with that that opening and then maybe let Sharon and others chime in just to finish up.
Sure.
Nancy, and then Sharon.
So, like, again, in thinking about this for funding, you know, the point is, once we create these relationships where we're, you know, sharing referrals and we're trying to find synergies, you know, you have to bring in other partners. So looking at the managed care organizations, because ultimately they're responsible for the health of these populations. We're a provider. And how do you start to look at value-based payment and looking at population health management that becomes efficient, that's data-driven? So I think that there's that kind of piece for what we're doing. And then the other thing is you have to understand how to use it appropriately. So every time there's an issue, you can't shoot out a referral to someone. There has to be a certain amount of how do you empower people to take care of these items on their own so that you're not necessarily care managing an entire population. So I think that we have to learn kind of how to do that better, you know, on the funding part. The other thing on Anchor Institution, for our produce, we figured out basically how to do that budget neutral, because we used to have 3 weeks of frozen food and that was sitting in freezers, okay? And it was like, you know, why do we need 3 weeks of frozen food? Because some day in the past someone said, oh, gee, we should have 3 weeks. So, you know, it's like people need whole foods, fresh foods. I mean, we're looking at patient experience. It relates to our star rating, which brings in more revenue. So, like, we got rid of the freezers and we put in refrigerators. And we turned the frozen budget into fresh produce, and then we turned down to our vendors because we have a little bit of push with them and said, all right, in the growing season, you need to provide us with fresh produce that is grown within New York State and a 250-mile area. So find those farms, and that's part of your contract. So that's a way of doing
that's
it
great.
Without extra money, but reallocating, which is similar to what you were saying.
So using the funding that's in the other sectors anyway,
being
and
creative,
how do you create
right,
the partnership?
And being a good salesperson.
Yeah. So. I'm getting the warning here, even though we may end a little later because our colleagues ended a little earlier. But anyway, this morning, Sharon, quick comment
yeah,
on
so
this
I would just
issue
say,
for you.
I think we're all facing significant challenges. I think we are looking at some of the policy changes. Somebody mentioned that earlier this morning, whether it's around a carbon tax, minimum wage, things that we want to participate in, but they result in significant resource allocation issues for us. And so that is something that we have to pay attention to. And also, quite frankly, philanthropy is changing,
mm-hmm.
Whether that's our corporate partners and institution partners who have been big providers who don't look at themselves as global institutions anymore, are not focused on the regional needs in the same way. So we have policy issues, we have philanthropy issues, and we all have facilities that are very old that require huge investments. And so there are great prioritization and sequencing issues that we mm-hmm. have to manage strategically over the next few
really important
years.
Let me open it up to the audience now. We have a few minutes, maybe a little over 5 minutes. So the gentleman there, the lady in the back, and then the gentleman over here. I think there's a mic allegedly being available to you. There we go. He got so excited about keeping time, he forgot about the microphone. There he goes. Just introduce yourself, because I think it's important for us to know kind of who's here, from which sector, which part of the world. Yeah.
Sure. Anthony Santiago. I'm with the National League of Cities.
Okay.
And we've been working in the healthy housing space for a while and actually just launched a pilot called Cities of Opportunity, which focuses on that intersection between, you know, design, economic opportunity, and healthy, affordable housing. So I really love everything that I'm hearing, and I'm hoping I can pull a couple cards after the panel. But I'd love to hear a little bit more about the role that local officials, you know, mayors or what have you, that they've played in your work. You know, share an experience maybe. I would like to take champion off the table because we know that's not to undersell how important that is and how that they can be champions for the work, but just something that kind of like either help triage, either open a door or overcome a challenge.
Yeah, I think it was mentioned in passing, this question of governance, and governance really is about political leadership plus the partners that are needed to get these projects done, and we definitely, it's a really critical issue to success.
Let me just jump on this and not answer the question as directly as you'd hope. Maybe somebody else can do that, but the one entity that is critical, or it certainly is very, very helpful when you're trying to develop a place-based initiative like this, is a very strong relationship with hopefully a very progressive public health director. So it's not an elected official, but it's certainly a key appointed official or public health department, certainly in a larger city like New York, because that is a critical connection. Public health is health in the community. Traditionally, it's epidemiology, but it's expanded so much. It's been mentioned health in all policies. This is really a public health concept. And if you can root a place-based initiative, whether it's for housing or farming or active recreation or youth development or anything like that, around a public health agenda, or at least incorporate a public health agenda, then that is a bridge to your local electeds. So it's very, very important. I just wanted to throw a shout-out to the public health director.
I think it's a really important notion. I want to take a little counter issue. I think some of that is contextual. It depends on where you are. In many instances, health directors, public health directors, don't have much money and they don't have much power. So I think the conceptual framework and the knowledge, and if you find one, as you said, great place to start. The elected official is maybe the last hill one climbs to get this leadership issue. It's easy in healthcare. It's very hard in health, in public health, in broader health, the way we're talking about it. So other quick comments on
I would just
this
add,
issue
I,
of the,
I actually
yeah,
think
leadership.
We're always focused on the higher level electeds, whether it's mayor or governors. But I also think the local electeds who are the greatest advocates for their communities are tremendously important, and sort of investing in that those relationships over time have been extremely important for us.
Yeah. I think somebody mentioned earlier the win-win notion. But the New York Academy of Medicine had been working on age-friendly New York City for a while and mapped where older people lived by councilmanic district. And older people, the data's there, they buy local and they vote. And it was very simple to share the initiative at that point, so it's an important issue. Yes, lady in the back, you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, Sharon Tepper with New York City Economic Development Corporation. This is a question for Dr. Hudson. I'm curious about your work in the Oakland School District, specifically on what health outcomes you were measuring with the local food initiative. I'm familiar with USDA-funded studies on the impact of school gardens on kids' activity levels. And I'm also interested to know, here at Columbia, what are you doing locally or potentially doing locally to look at other health initiatives like maybe the YMCA after-school program, which, you know, in terms of like the hub and spoke that Sharon spoke about, you know, the Y has spokes, you know, dozens and dozens of spokes reaching thousands of kids every day for 5 days a week at least. So sort of, you know, how does, you know, what are the opportunities here and what can we learn from what you did there?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in California, we've been fortunate enough to partner with the state. So they have the Healthy Kids Survey. So they let us insert a few questions there for parents as well as with the teachers and students to find out what's happening in terms of activity, food consumption, although we've done some observations directly there. That, as you'll know, with health and food, it's hard to say over time, like, what can you attribute to this and that, but we're really looking at activity levels, consumption, that sort of thing. And there are other aspects to this with our colleagues in public health, but also in education, talking to teachers and observing test scores and so forth. And then as with many of the school districts in California, as many of the children are coming from elsewhere, right? So we have some that are unaccompanied minors, some that have come from Syria, some that have come from Iran. So they're dealing with a whole host of other issues. And so we've been trying to engage not only around the food aspects of the school, but also taking food home to families and so forth. So the big issues around food security. In terms of what's happening here in New York, this is only my second year now living in New York, not even 2 years yet. I'm quite interested in engaging here, and I've been having conversations with my colleagues in California about doing something here in New York, and so I'm slowly engaging. One of the things that I've learned in my work is you first must listen and get to know people and build real partnerships. Many people mention trust, and that's, to me, is really important as opposed to just diving into an area that I'm just learning about. So that's a good question. Yeah.
That's great. So he's available for other activities. Yes, sir. Yeah.
Thanks. Hi, Tim Evans from New Jersey Future. We're a land use policy organization similar to RPA, just not as big. I only just earlier this week first heard the term social determinants of health. And I'm wondering if you could give me an example of what some of these are, other than the most obvious one, I guess, is I'm poor and I can't afford health insurance and I can't afford preventive health care. But let's say we suddenly had universal health care. Give me an example of a social determinant of health that universal health care wouldn't solve. And particularly being a land use guy, maybe something that arises based on where you live and not just on how much money you have.
Yeah, can I start this one? Because it's something I think it's really, really important distinction in the use of the term social determinants of health coming from the clinical community where I spent a good bit of my life and trying to move bridge with the public health and the broader community that's displayed on this slide. Social determinants of health, when talked about with clinicians, generally means the services, the social services, the other community services needed by an individual patient who has complex illness and costs a lot of money. And a lot of the initial work, I think, has really been thinking about care coordination. How do we bring those social services, the ability for a diabetic, for example, how do we get them access to healthy food? How do we help them find discounted exercise opportunities? How do we get them to the local park or create, you know, a change where they can then work? This may not necessarily change the conditions in the community to which that person returns when they leave the examining room. And that's the trick here. From a public health point of view, this is much more, and it's emerging in public health. I think Vincent's work is really an example of, you know, finding a good public health director. Many public health directors still are struggling with this intersectoral work as well. It's kind of new to everybody, but I think the notion here would be let's find out where that person comes from. Let's use GIS community mapping. And if we know there are no fresh fruits and vegetables in that neighborhood, if we know housing is in bad condition, if we know transportation is poor, what can we do to leverage, you know, the economic power of these large institutions in their communities and others? So it's a paradigm that has to come together. They're not competing. They have to be complementary. But it's sometimes a challenging conversation to bridge it. So I think it's a really important question, you know, for this discussion. So let me invite others to jump in on this.
And the other thing is that when you're looking at providing universal health care, so that's access, and I think, you know, you explained that. But the other piece of this is really, like, how do communities build wealth, and what is wealth? You know, social connectedness. We can have affordable housing that's rental, but at the end of the day, people don't gain equity in their home. And if you were to look to say, how do people gain wealth or gain equity and then pass it from generation to generation, traditionally in the United States, it's been owning something. So there's some new models that are coming back with community land trusts that basically allow people to have affordable housing but gain equity in that. And then when they go to sell it, that they can take out some of that equity and they could pass it down to their kids. And so they're building wealth over time versus just paying rent. So I think that universal health care allows access, but other things such as affordable, healthy food in a community that doesn't have it. So Boston Medical Center looked at this, and they still do an emergency food program, but they realized that there was no supermarket. So they went into a collaborative funding agreement with other partners, and similar to what you were doing for housing, they did the same thing in an opportunity zone. And they brought, there was an entrepreneur who now opened up a supermarket that has food at an affordable price. So there again, there could be all kinds of access to health care, but they needed a place where people could actually buy the food in the neighborhood. And that kind of looks to kind of social determinants of health. And then you have your banks that are doing financial coaching. So the point is, if you have X amount of dollars, how do you look at these dollars and budget them so that you're not going to, you know, same-day paychecking, you know, payday loans and things like that, where people can never build wealth because they're constantly in debt. So how do you work with that? So I think it's really multifaceted when you're looking at social determinants of health.
Let me just ask everybody, start with you, Vincent, at the end, just very quick, what's your key message to this audience about what's the most important thing in building healthy communities?
I think, and I'm glad you raised the question of the social determinants of health, because health starts in communities. Health essentially happens in communities, and I'm not trying to just sort of give you a tagline. But when you consider the social determinants of health that your question raised, which is a very, very important question, it's been acknowledged by organizations like the World Health Organization and Centers for Disease Control that health in communities, or the community conditions that foster good health or thwart good health, account for about 80% of the causal factors for whether or not you're going to live to a certain age, whether or not you're going to have early onset chronic illness, and also whether or not you're going to have a quality of life that's going to enable you to work, be educated, raise children, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the idea is that we have to look at health more broadly and really invest in where those causal factors are going to make the most difference.
Very good. Charles? Yeah.
Yeah, I share what
sentences and not paragraphs. We just, because we have to finish up here. Sorry.
Very quickly. It's the two combinations. It's broadly thinking about what health is in the community, but then implementing it in the neighborhood level. You know, don't bite off more than you can really do. The neighborhood works.
Yeah.
And building from that neighborhood development, I think, is what you can achieve success that gets built on.
Nancy?
I would say cross-sector partnerships. Leverage the work that's going on and bring it all together. And I think that's the takeaway that I would say.
Sharon?
I would say community connections, just finding the way for people to feel like there's a sense of belonging.
Yeah, community connections, engage. There's nothing more to say. Yeah.
Okay, this has been an absolutely fabulous panel. So you're going out well informed. Thank you all for organizing.
Thank you.
Okay, great. That's good. Kept this going.
I didn't bring it.